Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, you know, when you open your Macintosh computer, you hear a chime, and that's their trademark. Well, here's the trademark of the Commonwealth Club. Whoa. Glass top. Anyway, that means we have officially convened another session of the Commonwealth Club. And for our television viewers and radio viewers particularly, I want to say I'm proud to have sitting to my left David Gergen, who is an individual so familiar to us going back, if you go back this far, to the Nixon White House through the Ford presidency, Ronald Reagan, and William Jefferson Clinton. Who did I leave out?
Grover Cleveland.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah. Well, I knew I was going to screw up. And more fake news. The thing about David, I'm going to say a little bit about the fact that he runs a school in leadership at Harvard. He graduated from Harvard Law School. He's obviously been an excellent author and principally a commentator on PBS and CNN, among others. What did I leave out? The local TV station. But the gap that David fills is the need for to have somebody who can make sense out of all of this. We have screamers on the left, screamers on the right, and that seems to be the format for a lot of entertainment news these days. David is different. David has a perspective, a historical experience, and also the broad perspective of what constitutes leadership and what constitutes the principles of a democracy that we have to make sure that we preserve. So that's what we're driving at today, sure. David. And I think all of us have a deep hunger for hearing some rational insights into what's going on. And let me say one thing before I actually let David talk, is that we're speaking on July 24th, 2018. July 25th, 2018, things may be very different. Five tweets and et cetera. So we have to qualify everything by say we're talking as of today on this. David, I'm going to start with a very general question. We're talking about where is America headed. That's the topic today. But really, to answer that question, we have to know where we are now. And we'll explore that a little bit. But let's start at the 35-foot altitude, because you travel around the country, you speak with people. What do you see as the general psyche or emotional attitude of America right now?
Well, thank you. Thank you first and foremost for coming here today. I appreciate the. I think this is my fifth or sixth time at the Commonwealth Club, and I've always been well treated, and we've had respectful dialogue, and I'm looking forward to more of that today. And congratulations on your new building. This is terrific.
Yeah.
And I think George and all of you deserve a great deal of credit. I was good to be here with Kimberly, who has been your development person for the last 5 years, I guess, came here in the midst of the early days of all of this. And Roy, thank you for being here to host this. Roy's can't seem to hold down a job very
right.
long. We've all had sort of these, we've jumped from lily pad to lily pad as we've gone along. So where are we? I must say, for starters, there's no line that I think applies today. If you're not confused, you don't know what's going on. We've entered a passage that I think all of us are finding difficult to understand. I wake up some morning and thinking, asking, am I still living in the same country that I thought I was living in? Who are these people who believe so differently? And it's very clear that we've entered a period of enormous transition. David Brooks would argue that we're going through a paradigm shift. And I think that at West Point, they now, with the young cadets before they become officers, they describe to them the world that they're going to find once they leave West Point. And they use an acronym, VUCA, VUCA, VUCA. And it stands for volatility, uncertainty, chaos, and ambiguity. And doesn't that typify the world that so many of us find ourselves in, regardless of what field you're in? We're talking about politics and public affairs here today, but in almost any field, the sense of being unrooted, uprooted and disrupted. You know, disruption is a favorite word now in business schools to help young MBA types understand how the world is turning upside down. And this started long before Trump. It's curious to me about what held us together before and why we're not holding together now. I remember back in the days of toward the end of the Cold War, and we were, this is when the wall was coming down, the Soviet Union was collapsing. And Georgi Arbatov, who was ran the USSR, U.S. Think tank in Moscow, told some of visiting Americans, he said, "We, the Russians, are going to do something very dangerous for you. We're going to remove your sense of an enemy." Your sense of an enemy is what kept you together. Mm-hmm. And now with the end of the Cold War, people are going in different directions. Yeah. But it's obviously more than that. The changes that have taken place in technology have been extraordinarily disruptive. For the most part, very positive. But for an awful lot of people, they have left. It's been harder. That's also true in the world of trade and globalization. There have been many winners, but there have been also a lot of losers. Joseph Schumpeter, the famous economist, years and years ago said that capitalism was a form of creative destruction. And people get hurt in creative destruction, and we haven't had very good ways to solve the problems of people who've gotten hurt. And they have a lot of grievances. And increasingly, as we have dispersed as a people and sorted ourselves out, the great unwinding, as George Packer has called it, has meant that we don't know our neighbors as well as we once did. And more importantly, we tend to live in neighborhoods with people mostly like us. So that if you're in West Virginia or a flyover country, you're living in a very different universe almost than if you're living in San Francisco or Boston, where I live. And so I think we have to understand that the world is changing rapidly. It started before Trump. And frankly, I don't think the end of Trump means the end of uncertainty or the end of polarization or the end of a poisonous politics. What I do think is true is that we have come through tough periods before. And one of the great hallmarks of this country has been our resilience. I commend to you a new book by John Meacham, one of my favorite authors these days. He's got a book out. What do you need here? You go to the cards.
Thank you.
John Meacham's got a book out called The Soul of America. And it's quite striking. The early part of the book about the early days of the founding are, you know, I think most people appreciate that. But there are long sections on times that we have not remembered as well as we should. Such as the Reconstruction in the South and then the rise of the KKK and the Jim Crow laws that came with that. We're really difficult times, much more so than we understand, but we worked our way through them and came out on the other side. We worked our way through the Depression and came out on the other side. Winston Churchill once said, we haven't come this far through such hard times because we're made of cotton candy. There's a much stronger fiber in the American tradition that has allowed us to bounce back. I don't think we're smarter than other people. We've made a lot of mistakes in our public life over time, but we tend to self-correct for mistakes. That's been our history. And I think the looming question, and John Meacham's book is pretty optimistic about where we're heading, where we're going. But the looming question is whether we are going to find that our growing multi-ethnic society is going to be able to hold together. You know, we have our national motto is E Pluribus Unum, E Pluribus Unum, from many, one. And there's a big question whether we now have too much pluribus and not enough unum, and whether we can bring ourselves back together. I think, Roy, let me wrap this up by saying the one of the overriding issues, if perhaps the overriding issue right now in our public life, is whether our democracy is going to survive as we have known it. All over the world, there is a hunger now, given the changing conditions all countries are grappling with. There's a hunger for new leadership, for breaking out of traditions. And in some countries, that's going pretty well with the fresh leadership. I would argue, look at France and Macron. He's taken off very, very well. As Angela Merkel is having to fight a rear guard action and is losing some of her authority in Europe. He's emerging as the leader of the European Union. He formed a political party by himself, basically, out of nowhere, and came and captured the reins in Paris. There's this wonderful picture at the end of the World Cup. I don't know if you've seen this picture when he's standing cheering the French win, and there's so much like dynamism and charisma and what he does. You look at that and say, no wonder the French feel so revived. He's bringing interesting things to it. Argentina's another country which is under Macri, is coming along very, very well. But look at Canada. I think what Trudeau was doing in Canada is quite fascinating. He is more than half his cabinet are women. He has made empowerment the central theme and the central emphasis of his time in leadership there. He will not go on a public panel. He won't go on any panel that is not gender balanced. That means one of us has to leave here. Right?
Yeah,
I'm not sure which one. Maybe it'll be me. But yeah. But he's very popular because of that. Because he's, the agenda has changed a lot. A lot of things that are on people's minds today are different in that. And equity, whether it's gender equity or economic equity, has become central to what we are. So in some countries, things have gone very well. But there are a great number of countries where this thirst for new leadership has actually led down the wrong path. And that is the number of countries in which democratically elected leaders have taken their countries in authoritarian directions. There are several books out about democracy now and its the health of democracy, the threats to democracy. The one I think is I would commend to you is Why Democracies or How Democracies Die. How Democracies Die. It's by two Harvard professors. It's very accessible. It's fairly short, but it has a big message. And essentially it argues, look, up through the end of the Cold War, a number of governments toppled. But they mostly toppled at the hands of military dictatorships. Since the end of the Cold War, countries that have sort of changed directions and are moving toward authoritarians are doing so at the hands of newly elected Democrats, democratically elected people. And these strong men have emerged in country. Europe is the most obvious example for any American, whether you look at Hungary or Poland or especially Turkey, but now what's going on in Italy, the alt-right movements that are building up are taking those countries in much more authoritarian directions and are shaking the European Union to their core. You can go on from there into around the world, whether it be the Philippines or Venezuela. There are a dozen countries, serious major countries. That have moved toward in authoritarian directions. And that is the big question because America has not yet entered a more authoritarian period, but there are trend lines now in this country which are the preludes to authoritarianism. And the countries which have gone in that direction, almost uniformly, the democratically elected leaders have started by denigrating and dismantling and driving down the approval of its justice authorities, of the legal authorities of the country. They've all been treated as, we can't trust them. They've been denigrated. And there's been an effort then in some of several countries to denigrate other forms of authority outside the realm of the strongman, such as the intelligence agencies. In all those countries, there's been attacks on the free press. Because what we see is systematically an effort to denigrate everybody who's not the leader or around within the circle of the leader. Does that sound fairly familiar?
Yeah.
So that, to me, we're not there yet. But we should be very vigilant. We should be afraid, very afraid, of where all these things could lead. And that, to me, is this serious challenge. And overriding that, if I'm one more minute, the authors of How Democracies Die point out in their concluding pages that America is moving in a direction which we celebrate. I celebrate, living in San Francisco, you celebrate. And the diversity in our country, I find very appealing. I think it's one of our great strengths. Bill Clinton used to say, diversity should not be our enemy, it should be our strength. I believe that to be true. It is also true, as they point out in that book about democracies dying, that we are moving toward a majority-minority country, right? There's not going to be any group which is a majority. Whites are going to be outnumbered by other groups already in California, already in places like, you know, Arizona and New Mexico, but it's coming now to the whole country. And they make the argument that no multi-ethnic society in modern times has succeeded very well in keeping a democracy. So a lot of this depends on how we live with each other and how we listen to people with other perspectives and whether we're respectful and empathic and understand this is a big, diverse country and their diversity should be our strength.
Thank you.
Sure.
Let's drill down on that a bit. You talk about your concern our democracy may be in jeopardy. And if you think about our democracy, it's really founded on the notion of representative democracy.
Yes.
I'm going to say four branches of government. We have the Article 1, 2, 3, but then we have the freedom of the press under the First Amendment.
Right.
It strikes me that, let's take those separately. Let's talk first about our Congress.
Mm-hmm.
One of the assumptions in the way our founders structured it is that the members of Congress would decide questions based on what they felt was the common good.
Yes.
You can disagree what
right.
that is.
Right.
But that's the guideline. I'm concerned with Citizens United and other factors that we're losing that, and I wonder if you could comment on how you see the Congress functioning right now.
Well, the Congress is not functioning well at all. Let's start with that. And I think members themselves feel embarrassed about what, you know, they didn't. How do you feel if you run, have to raise a ton of money, you get to Washington, and you wake up one morning, you read a poll that says that members of Congress are seen less favorably than cockroaches.
Right.
That really gives you a lot of inspiration, you know, to get in there and fight for the good cause. Look, one of the things that's going on that has been, I think, is now finally receiving serious attention is that beyond money, and I'll come back to money, but is the degree of gerrymandering that we have. You know, mm-hmm. the Economist just did a big cover package on how unequal we are. Because of gerrymandering, look, what happens is this. Every 10 years, we take a national census, right? And once you have the national census in, then you figure out how do you distribute the seats for members of Congress to fit how the population has changed. And that means that lines are redrawn, and often, you know, states and the Sun Belt have been seeing rises in population, so you have to create more congressional districts. And states in the Northeast, for example, and some other states are shrinking in population as a percentage, and they have to reduce the number of seats. So there's a lot of line drawing that goes into that. Every 10 years, the Republicans who have been much more strategic than Democrats as a general proposition for the last 10 or 20 years saw long ago that the census of 2010 was going to be very determinative of our politics in the 10 years that followed up to 2020. And so they put a big effort into winning the governorships and winning the state houses, the state legislatures, back in 2010, off-year elections. And very quickly they gathered in lots and lots of power. And so in most states, the lines have been redrawn by Republicans. And the lines are drawn in such a way that if the Democrats beat the Republicans, and if you tally up all the votes that are coming in a midterm, and the Democrats win by, say, 100,000 votes over the Republicans are going to hold the House. 200,000, 300,000. The Democrats, in order to win back the House, are estimated to need a seven-point lead, a seven-point lead in total votes over the other side. That means it's got to be, like, at least 53-46. That is a big win. That means you've got to have a big wave to get there. And that's why the Democrats right now are chomping the bit. They think their wave will be big enough. Nobody can be quite certain. A wave that big is very, very unusual. And so it means the Democrats, if they resist, if they want to build up their resistance, they have to stay at it. And they have to take their politics as seriously as conservatives have. You know, the Republicans, you may think their ideas are wrong, but watch their strategy. They play for keeps. They're serious about it. And they're not weekend warriors. They're in it because they care deeply about the principles they're fighting for. And they're willing to fight hard for them. And politics ain't beanbag. You know, it's a contact sport. And if the Democrats want to win this, and they should be in a position to win this, right? That means that they've got to really stay at it and build up a big coalition of people to pour out. And that may or may not happen. But understand that the system is tilted toward the Republicans. The same thing is true of the Electoral College. You know, that you the obvious tilt there when California only gets when you go to vote in California, your vote counts for like 1/700th of what it means in a state like Montana, you know, in terms of how many people vote and how many seats they get as a result of that in the Senate. And then there's the influence of money, and money has been crucial factor. I'd like to just one thing before we leave. I'd like to talk a little bit about signs of hope because you can get pretty depressed.
I'm saving that for last.
Yeah, exactly. because I do want to talk a little bit about the younger generation, but the money that I've gotten close to some campaigns this year, and it's stunning to me how much time they have to spend on it, how important it is to get through a primary, how much money you have to raise, and you've got to be at it constantly. And if once you give, you know, $50 to one of these campaigns, you will hear from them 500 times, you know, because they can use the internet to get to you and one thing and another. And but they're so dependent on the money, and the system is way out of whack. And you take all of that. And then take the fact that the middle of American politics has essentially disappeared. And people don't work across the aisle. And if you're a Republican moderate and you vote with the Democrats, you will get a primary opponent who's going to come at you from your right. And if you're a moderate Democrat, you're going to get a primary opponent who's likely to come at you from your left. And so all the incentives, if you're in a fairly centrist person, is to move to the edge, is to move to the extreme. That there's a built-in incentives for that, and what that means is that the politics has become increasingly polarized, and poisonous. If you look at the data now, there are a great number of people in this country who do not want their son or daughter to marry someone from the other party. Seriously. Well, seriously.
Yeah.
And that's like a big deal. You know, I know families where there's one member of the family who voted for Trump and there's another member or two members of the family who voted, you know, for Hillary. And it's, you don't want to talk about it at Thanksgiving. You don't want to go there.
Yeah.
Your family is more important.
Yeah.
And each of the groups looks down at the other one and said, oh, my God. And going on college campuses is a big deal on college campuses now. Because the liberal factions have taken over so many college campuses. You know, conservatives don't feel welcome. And a lot of parents, You know, among Republicans right now, 57% of Republicans say American colleges and universities are bad for the nation. Majority of Republicans think they're bad for the nation because they, and they said, why do I want to pay $60,000 to have my kid go to that school and be indoctrinated and turn into a communist or a socialist? Socialist, that's a big thing. Now, if you ask young people today, do you believe in socialism or capitalism? More people say socialism. And for the conservatives, that means, where'd they get that? They went to college.
Yeah.
They got brainwashed in college. How could they possibly believe that? And I paid $60,000 a year for that investment. So I think it's important to understand that a lot of this started before Trump. It's accelerated under Trump. And we're moving more rapidly in the direction of where the sides are like this. You know, they're clenched. I came from a time, I miss them so much. The World War II generation was running Washington. There were people who basically were young men and young women who came through the Second World War. Most, we had seven presidents in a row from John Kennedy through George H.W. Bush who all wore a military uniform. And all but one served during the Second World War. Jimmy Carter was in the Naval Academy when the war ended, and he went on to serve honorably then. All seven were then were heavily influenced and shaped by that experience. Roy is was a veteran, a Marine veteran, and you know how...
Yeah, it was incredibly shaping.
Yeah, very, very, very shaping.
Yeah.
But it shaped people in a positive way. When I went to Washington in 1970 or so, there were people who considered themselves strong Democrats or people who considered themselves strong Republicans, but they thought of themselves as first and foremost strong Americans. They had fought under the same flag, and there was certain affinity because they'd sacrificed together, but they were all in it together. Famously, the Reagan-Tip O'Neill relationship. You know, we had a very conservative president and a very liberal Speaker of the House. And in today's world, they wouldn't talk to each other, right? But then they had an understanding that before 5 o'clock, each one of them could get up on a soapbox and give a pretty good slug to the other one, and that was just sort of the way it was. But after 5 o'clock, you put down your differences, and you could lift up a glass, and you could tell old Irish jokes and stories and laugh and scratch and have a good time together. And Reagan and Tip actually then worked together on various major legislative initiatives, starting with Social Security reform in 1982-83. They got that done in a bipartisan way. Later on, they worked on tax reform, overhauling the whole tax system. They got that done with a supermajority in the Senate, with 65, 67 votes on tax reform. And so Reagan and Tip developed this relationship. First of all, they started working together, then they started trusting each other. And then there was actually an affection for each other. So when Tip turned like 70, I think it was, Reagan gave a birthday party for him in the White House. And at the end of the, and had all his Tip's friends there. And at the end of the luncheon, Reagan got up and gave a toast. And he'd written out this doggerel as he was given to do. And he said, Tip, if I had a ticket to heaven and you didn't have one too, well, I'd give my ticket back and go to hell with you. There was a lot of goodwill.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen that. You know, Danny Roskinkowski, Democrat, and John Boehner, Republican in Washington, used to drive back to their homes in the Midwest together. For a week, and they went back for a weekend. They'd get in the same car and drive back together. There was a lot of that. Yeah. There was a real... When Teddy died, Orrin Hatch came to his funeral and he sang. You know, there was a genuine friendship among people like that. And we've lost a lot of that. The politics has lost some of its sweetness. It's lost some of the bonds that hold people together. And to go back to this E pluribus unum, they were united. And that's the leaders of the future are going to have to be people who unite us. That's who we're going to look up to. And I think we can get there, but more about later.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, Please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the second issue, the fourth branch of government, the journalism.
I thought it was the press.
Well, journalism, yeah.
The fake press, fake news, right?
Both kinds, really, yeah. You've actually just asked the question for me, because it strikes me that there's an overwhelming attack right now on the not just the opinions of journalism, but the credibility and the validity of journalism. Yep. And it's your business.
Well, I think the attacks have been, I think they've been vastly overdone. We know one thing, that the Russians are paying for some of them. The Russians are actively trying to sow divisions among us, and they take out these websites, they take out these various positions on the internet, and go after and spread. They intentionally spread things that are not true, and they make the press. They try to make the press look ridiculous. It's been extremely disturbing that same attack on the press has been coming so frequently out of this White House. I've known presidents in the past who have been very, I can just recite chapter and verse of how upset people have been at various individual stories. But in the past, the relationship has worked because of a sense of professionalism on each side, recognition. Reagan, for example, was elected as a conservative, most conservative, and yet he had very, very good press evaluations. In fact, one person, Sidney Blumenthal, who was a journalist, he wrote a book called On Bended Knee, and he said, in effect, that the press had been on bended knee to Reagan. Mm-hmm. Well, the reason Reagan got along well was not because he curried favor with them or flattered them. It was because he respected them. And he understood, if you're a journalist, you've got a different job. You have to report to your readers. They're your boss. That's different from what a president may feel and what his alliances and loyalties are to the larger population. And we have, I think, introduced this notion that journalists are savages who are only out there to bring Trump down, or to bring, which isn't true. I mean, people around Bill Clinton could barely speak to the New York Times. They were so angry about things that were printed there. But it was also true that George W. Bush, people around Bush wouldn't read the New York Times, because they thought they were so nasty. Well, that's, there's much less favoritism in the traditional press than people think. But I think this idea of constantly, slamming the press is destructive. It's destructive. We need a vigilant press. Believe me, the checks and balances, the press are important to the checks and balances in this country. The secret of our success, to a significant degree, and our resilience, has been that our Constitution and our traditions built around the Constitution, the unwritten laws, have held power in check. They've held people accountable in the White House. And you, if you're in the party that's controlling the White House, it may be aggravating and irritating as all hell. But when you're out of the White House and the other party controls the White House, you sure as heck want to press. It's tough, and ask tough questions. It's good. It's healthy for democracy. So there's a difference, between being a watchdog and being a Rottweiler. And I think the issue for those of us who are privileged enough to speak on television or, to have a voice in our democracy, the issue for us right now is to maintain more balance and to maintain respect for people of alternative perspectives, to realize that basically right now there are two narratives about the Trump administration that are competing with each other. One narrative that you hear a lot about here in places like on the West Coast, California and Oregon and Washington, and you certainly hear a lot about in the Northeast where I live, the narrative is this man is totally unsuited for the presidency. He's a narcissist. He's mean. He's a bully. He's a misogynist. He lies like crazy. He has no respect for the institutions of government. All the things that add up to terrible president, terrible president. That's one narrative. There is a competing narrative that we ought to pay more attention to that's coming from the other side and says, yes, he is all those things, but look at the results. Look at the results. And this is a view you find not only among Trump baseline voters, but you find it a lot in the business community. People who say, you know, look what he did. He promised he would reform taxes, bring our tax rates down. He has done that. He promised he would deregulate. And whether you like it or dislike it, I hate some of the deregulation, say, an endangered species kind of stuff that's coming around now. But that's what he promised. And for a lot of groups, he's delivering. They think that people think that China, you know, a lot of business people think China has been unfair in its trade practices. It steals our secrets. You know, it's done all sorts of things to us that are unfair. At least he's standing up. The Chinese, is he overdoing it? Yes, he's overdoing it. But look at from a lot of people's point of view, you look at that, you look at the fact he took on North Korea, you know, he's actually getting NATO to pay more, and they've not been paying their share. You know, he's finally got them to get off it. You know, there are some other issues that got that going, like the invasion of Ukraine. But the fact is, from the point of view of his supporters, he's done a lot of things they like, and he's standing up for things, and he's standing up to the establishment. Now, I don't happen to share a lot of those views, but I sure as hell think we don't need to look upon people who support Trump as like second-class citizens. You know, they have legitimate grievances in many cases, and what we need to do is to listen to each other and understand and see if we can persuade each other by putting down our, you know, our hammer and tongue and actually having serious conversations. Because we're tearing ourselves apart right now. You know, we the people are participating in something. It's not just Trump. We the people bear responsibility as well as citizens.
It strikes me that I'm trying to think of the dynamic that brings about of so many of the things you're describing.
Sure.
And when I think back all the way, I wasn't alive, but when Roosevelt ran, it was on a note of optimism. And it goes all the way forward to Kennedy and to even George W. Bush wrote on compassion. Obama ran on hope. Now we're running on fear.
Fear and grievances.
Grievances.
Resentments.
Resentment.
Yep, yep. I don't think there's any question that Trump, but he's not alone, is running, has succeeded by exploiting our grievances, mm-hmm. and exploiting differences.
Right.
You know, it is previous presidents have welcomed, for the most part, immigration.
Mm-hmm.
It's been something that has been part of, they see it as our strength. I went to Ellis Island recently. 12 million people came through Ellis Island. Up until from the late 19th century into the early 20th century, 12 million people came through. Only 2% got turned back. And when Franklin Roosevelt went to speak to the Daughters of the American Revolution, very traditional,
mm-hmm.
Daughters of the American Revolution, he opened by saying, fellow immigrants.
Yeah.
Fellow
right.
Because people in those days realized that we all came on different ships, but now we're in the same boat together. And it made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And there was hope in immigration. And, economists will tell you today, I mean, this issue is tearing us apart far more than it should be. The number of people coming in from Mexico is reversed. I mean, they're going back now.
Yeah.
This is not a huge problem. It is a political problem that's being, because we're ripping ourselves over all this, these threats to our well-being, there's so many more important problems that we should be facing up to, but this immigration stuff is what the alt-right is running on across Europe. You know, the fear of the other, the fear of someone who's not like you, the fear of someone who has a different skin color, has a different religious background, all those other things that they're running on. And we need to keep reminding ourselves of the values that we hold dear and what has held us together. I had the opportunity, the privilege, really, to go yesterday to Muir Woods. I hadn't been there in a long time. And you see the pictures out there, but go down that cathedral of Redwoods, that where they had the commemoration in 1945, in May of 1945. FDR died in April. And then they had the UN, the convening of the UN organization, you know, to put together the UN here in San Francisco. And all the delegates went out to the Muir Woods to commemorate Franklin Roosevelt, because he had been such a voice of hope.
Yeah.
He'd represented, and at the time when lights were going out all over Europe, as it was said, he kept the torch burning for democracy and for freedom, and was beloved not only in this country but in Europe in ways that we, you know, can't remember. The writer Isaiah Berlin, I don't know if you're familiar with him, some people called him Isaiah, was a wonderful European and a public intellectual, British. And he wrote an essay about FDR, that of how much, how he had, FDR had not just saved America, but helped save Europe, and saw that we were shared, we had a shared destiny. And it's crazy to drive the Europeans away. It is idiotic. The one thing we've had in terms of our power relationship with against the Chinese or against the Russians is they have virtually no friends around the world. We have had friends everywhere. There, China and Russia are encircled by our friends. And that makes a big difference in a way, the power relationship to the world. We drive these nations away from us and turn them into our enemies, or become unreliable, as we are becoming unreliable in terms of our international obligations, the things we signed up for. Then you're going to find, as we are now seeing, that nations in Asia, for example, will have no choice but to ally themselves more closely with the Chinese. And even the peoples around Russia are finding that there are advantages of lining up with the Russians. I mean, people in Western Europe, people in Italy are now doing that. We need those friends. They were an important part of what has kept us strong. Does it cost us a few dollars more sometimes? Yeah, but that's the price of leadership. It's an easy one. So secondary, so such a small amount of money for NATO. And we're talking about something fundamental. We're talking about the most successful alliance in the history of the earth. That after having two world wars starting in Europe, to have put this alliance in place and have no more wars in 70 years. What the hell are we talking about getting rid of NATO? You got to be nuts to say you want to move forward. Do you want to make some adjustments? Yeah. Thank you.
Well, this thread that you've started developing ties into about half of the questions that I have here. So let me try to consolidate half of these questions into a question which will pick up on that thread. We pulled out of NAFTA, we pulled out of the Paris Accord, we pulled out of the Iranian Treaty, we pulled out of the TPP, and now we're attacking our traditional alliances such as the G7 and the and NATO. And then we had the Helsinki press conference. Now, could you in some way help us? Because what that's, I'm going to suggest what that says is that we are realigning ourselves from a leader in the world who engages in multilateral engagement, not only with our allies, but with our competitors. And we are seeking to go it alone, and we're creating a leadership vacuum. So you were in Helsinki. Work backwards, whichever direction you want to go. But that was about half of these questions.
Well, I think the most important political question hanging over us is whether our own democracy will survive and thrive. But that leads into the larger concern about the world and what direction the world itself will take. If we move from a period of what I think was enlightened leadership after the Second World War. Let's remember a little, just a very brief tour of history here. After the First World War, we imposed a punitive peace on Germany, which was going to leave them resentful, and eventually led to, after the 20s, led to the rise of Nazism as a pushback against what they thought that how the world had mistreated them. And Hitler played to all those resentments in those years. In the 30s, what we saw is not just in Germany, but across much of Europe, especially with the Depression, we saw one nation after another say, let's make Germany great again, let's make France great again, let's make the UK great again. And there was a war against all, among all, each country looking for an advantage. And that's how we got into the tariff wars of the 1930s. That with Smoot-Hawley and others that helped to drive us into the Depression. And then also brought that, the loss of democracies, and people all went their separate ways. And coming out of that, one of the periods in which we, the Americans, were blessed with the wise men who came, who were in Washington, that were around Harry Truman. And some of them were Republicans. They were not just Democrats. They were it was pretty bipartisan. But Truman collected around him the wise people of that age who were very internationalist in outlook. And, you know, whether it be a Dean Acheson or a George Marshall or Lovett, or you can go through Robert Lovett, you can go through the list of people who were around him. And it was an amazingly enlightened period of American leadership. And it was from essentially the end of the war, 45, onward, that here in San Francisco, the UN was born, which was they tried to correct from what the League of Nations, the failure of the League of Nations after the First World War, the UN was regarded as a much better way to go, because it was collective leadership, seen as collective leadership. We helped to form the GATT, which was the World Trading Organization, has become the world WTO of today. We were in there with the IMF. You can go through in Bretton Woods, but it was NATO. A lot of institutions, we the Americans took the lead in setting up those institutions. We poured money into the Marshall Fund. We didn't try to sort of chisel here and chisel there and you can squeeze them here and squeeze them there. We said, you need help. And it was a play for the long term, and it was strategic. We've lost our sense of strategy, among other things. But the Americans, if this was the global world that we wanted, this was what our forefathers saw as a world that would be preferable, and that is one in which nations cooperated, in which they were free markets and free peoples, and that we shared a destiny as a global world. And we increasingly in recent years have been working with young leaders coming up from different countries to see themselves not only as belonging to that nation, but to see themselves as having global responsibilities, being global citizens. We're not able to solve a lot of the problems of today unless we work together as nations. If you look at our individual governments nation by nation, it's been well said the governments of today are too big to solve the small problems, and they're too small to solve the big problems. and they have to band together. We're not going to make it on climate change. And if anything is more imperiled right now, it's our climate. And you can just see it day to day now. Where Trump has got us so mesmerized, we're not watching what's happening over here on the climate side the way we should. But the point is, we could all make progress together, and some nations were going to fall behind, but then we're there to help them and that sort of thing. And what the Steve Bannons of the world are trying to not just disrupt, but to demolish that system of alliances and set of responsibilities and global perspective and replace it and going back to what we had in the 20s and 30s. You know, dog eat dog. You know, our gain is your loss is our gain. You know, a zero-sum game among nations. And we're at the forefront of that right now as a country, which is astonishing given the success we've had. You know, the 70 years of peace not only saved the blood and treasure that we were losing in two world wars, but it made us rich. You know, we're still doing very well. And by the way, it lifted tons and tons of people in places like China out of poverty. So the world has gone a better course now. And we're moving in all sorts of positive directions. Like Steven Pinker has a book out about how we're much more of an enlightenment country than we think we are, and the world is doing a lot better. And by the way, there's less violence than there used to be historically in the world. There are a lot of big name trends. A lot of them are moving in this positive direction, and along they come these people who want to tear it down. And it's like, what are we doing here? And we deserve to have a serious conversation among the American people about the benefits and the losses, and understand that in any kind of churn, some people are going to get hurt, and we've got to be much better than we've been doing at looking after the people who are getting hurt, people who don't have the education that they compete for 21st century jobs. You know, there are over 6 million jobs in this country right now that can't be filled. Most of them because people don't have, the applicants don't have the kind of training they need to fill those jobs. Well, that's on us. What kind of education system will we produce? We've been talking about education reform for years, and we've been making progress in high school graduation rates, but we're not making a lot of progress. We're not moving the needle on how much people actually know for the jobs that exist in the 21st century. And I will tell you, the anti-globalists, you know, let's go back to a dog-eat-dog world, are going to pull the pillars down if we're not careful. And that's why people have got to be serious about this. Is a very vulnerable, pivotal time, and it could go either way. And I don't think we know. I keep thinking we're going to wind up doing well, and I'm very hopeful about that. But you've got to be willing to say the dark side could prevail here. And as a citizen, your responsibility is to take it seriously and to participate, not just vote, but participate.
Yeah. Well, there's two places that dialogue can happen. One is in Congress, and the other is in the fall election. Do you see these policies actually becoming in the forefront?
Well, I do. I think over time, yes. I think these arguments are going to be settled at the ballot box.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be settled in the midterms. They're going to be settled in the general election. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the Democrats, as I said before, I think are a little overconfident about the midterms. The general election, I think, is going to be one of the most important. My own view is I'm among those.
You mean 2020?
2020.
Yeah.
My own view is I'm among those who believe that if the Democrats take back the House, they ought to be very, very careful and cautious about moving with impeachment. I thought it was an outrage when Republicans impeached Bill Clinton back in the 90s. I did not think that what we were dealing with rose to the level of throwing a president out of office. I was there for Nixon. I thought he needed to go. I thought that was that once the smoking gun was there and we knew that he'd been lying from the start, I was in his White House running the speechwriting team and research team. It was clear he had to go. But I thought with Clinton, it was not. With the Trump thing, he has so muddied the waters and so caused so much distrust in Mueller and the team around Mueller that I worry that an impeachment process led by Democrats between 2018 and 2020, after the midterms and before the general election, could very well be a serious mistake. I think the Democrats are better off trying to settle this at the ballot box. Let the American people decide. You know, who should be the president in the next 4 years? That seems to me a fair way to resolve something. Because look, the Democrats are not going to have the votes. Let's say they get the House back, and they move ahead with impeachment. They could do that, and they could vote impeachment as Republicans did against Clinton. But then it goes over to the Senate for a trial. If you get an impeachment, it's like an indictment, and then you go to trial over in the Senate. You need, to succeed in the Senate, you need 2/3 of the votes. It means you need 67 votes. Republicans are going to have 49, 50, 51, 52 after the midterm. There is no way in hell to get from that number to finding him guilty. Absent some blockbuster thing we don't see yet. They're not going to succeed. And the Republicans will argue it's a coup. It's a silent coup led by Democrats, aided and abetted by a fake press. aided and abetted by, you know, the college campuses and all those liberals out there on the college campuses, and the public intellectuals have been going after him. And this has been their effort from the beginning, is to get him out under spurious, charges. And Mueller was let, he has all these Democrats in there working for him and so forth and so on. They all get money to the Democratic Party. The whole thing's a setup. You can imagine. And then we take our polls and we find out the country's divided 55-45 right. or something like that. Yeah. And where are we? We haven't really fundamentally resolved it. And we need a way to break this and be able to move on. We cannot be engaged in Trumpism and worrying about Trump. For the next 6 years as a country. We've got to get some things done here, too.
Let me try to squeeze in one more sure. audience question, then I want to go to Hope.
Okay.
Okay. The question is, that it ties into really what we were talking about NATO, that we seem to be disaligning ourselves from our traditional allies, but also aligning ourselves more closely with authoritarian democracies or authoritarian governments.
Yep.
Several people would like you to comment on that, and I think the starting point is the press conference in Helsinki.
Well, I've never known a president who has been so strongly drawn to authoritarian leaders. We have had instances in the past when we were in the Cold War when we made friends with authoritarian governments. Jean Kirkpatrick, famously argued before she became, went to work for Reagan, that when you're facing a hostile power and it could demolish you, that it's fine to work with an authoritarian because you need every ally you can get. So we did break bread with a number of countries that were more authoritarian. But since then, we have been promoting democracy. Mm-hmm. We've been actively trying to promote democracy. The National Endowment for Democracy, NED, as it's called. I was very involved in when the wall went down to try to bring democracies to Eastern Europe. As they were liberated. And I think for the most part it went reasonably mm-hmm. well. There's backsliding now in Hungary and Slovakia, but and Poland. But this attraction, mutual attraction to strongman, I get why President Trump would be sympathetic or find them sort of like he would find himself sort of at home with them or congenial with them. But I think what one senses is that he increasingly has a great man theory of history, and that the world would be better if there were three or four really mm-hmm. strong men mm-hmm. from different major powers, the U.S., the USSR, or the Russia, and China, if those three, with occasional help somewhere else,
yeah.
would run the world. And that would produce a more magnanimous world. Well, if you go back into the classics and go back and read Plutarch, it's true that there were ages when great men sort of operated. But we live in a very different world now where democracies and the voices of the people are extremely important. And leadership is all about, it's no longer about great single men. It is increasingly about teams and nations in cooperation and transparency and accountability, the kind of values that we now place on leadership, that to be drawn to these strongmen like Erdogan or Putin or Xi, as much as we need to be keeping we really need to understand what's happening in China and what questions that's going to raise over the long term. It's unnatural for a democratic leader to be as drawn to. Our relationship with Stalin, people say, well, the conservatives say, well, look at how we got along with Stalin. It's true, but it was a very, a very short-term deal. Yeah. For the purpose of this exercise, purpose of this war, we need each other. But when it's over, it's over. And we're not going to march happily arm in arm into the sunset. People understood that the Soviets remained a serious adversary, And boy, did they show it as the Iron Curtain came slamming down after the end of the Cold War, after the end of the Second World War. And so to think that we are friends with Putin is so upsetting to the National Intelligence Committee. I mean, people who spent years trying to figure out what Russia is up to under Putin see him as a thug. Now, George W. Bush famously when he met Putin, came away and said, "I looked into his eyes and I could see the soul of a man." But it was Bob Gates, whom I think was one of the best public servants of our time, who was running the CIA, running the intelligence operation, became defense secretary. He said, "I looked in the eyes of Putin, and what I saw was a cold-blooded killer." Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that. We have to remember. I don't know how much time we have.
We have enough time to talk about hope.
Because I've got one little I've got one little story to go with it.
We can go over a little bit. That's fine.
Listen, I come from the Patriot country. The New England Patriots are a big deal where I live. And the owner of the New England Patriots is a friend named Bob Kraft, who's been a terrific citizen of Boston and the New England. So shortly, the Patriots, not a very good team when he bought them, and he shortly but getting built the team up and got to the Super Bowl very quickly and got a Super Bowl ring. And which he was extraordinarily proud of. I'm not sure if you've ever seen a Super Bowl ring. I have not. But they're huge. You've got to be about 320 pounds to wear one of these.
Yeah. Can't get them through security.
Shortly after Bob Kraft got his first Super Bowl ring, he went with a group of American CEOs on a private mission to Russia to essentially for commercial purposes to introduce more trade and one thing and another. And he took a Super Bowl ring with him. There was a reception the night before they were supposed to leave, got to come back from Moscow to the U.S. There was a reception with Putin. And Kraft took the ring to the reception. And then he was in a little circle of people, and he brought the ring out to show to people, started talking about it. Putin said, "Can I see that?" And so Kraft gives him the ring. Putin takes the ring, puts it on his finger. He's shining that one thing. And Putin said, "You know, you could kill somebody with this ring." Very strange comment. Kraft said, "Well, you could kill somebody with a lot of things, I suppose." So, they talked for a while. And then the time came, essentially, for Putin to get back the ring. You know, etiquette says, "You now get back the ring." Putin turned on his heels and walked away from the group. Still had the ring on. And Kraft went over to the organizers and said, "My ring." And they said, "Oh, don't worry, Mr. Kraft. We have a farewell breakfast in the morning. Vladimir Putin will be there, and you can get the ring from him." Then he said, "Okay." So he goes to the breakfast next morning. Putin doesn't show. Does not show. They have to hustle off to the airport. They get an airplane. They fly back over the Atlantic, and Kraft is commiserating. He's talking to a bunch of the CEOs, and he tells them the story. So what happened? And he forgets that one of the people in the group was Rupert Murdoch, who owns the New York Post and Page Six, which is the gossip cage of New York. Next morning, Putin steals Kraft's ring. And Kraft said, "Well," he was embarrassed. He said, "Maybe I'll get my ring back. But 11 o'clock that morning, Kraft got a call from the State Department. Yeah. They said, "Mr. Kraft, we have a problem." And he said, "You bet your ass we have a problem." And Kraft said, I want my ring back. And they said, "That's not the problem. The problem is Page Six is getting us creating a real brouhaha internationally. And it's going to be we're going to have an incident with the Russians if we're not careful." At noon that day, Bob Kraft felt compelled to issue a statement that said, "There's been a terrible misunderstanding. In the interest of friendship with the Russian people, I gave Mr. Putin my ring." So that sort of ended the controversy. But guess what? He's never seen the ring since.
Whoa.
One day you're going to take your grandkids to the Kremlin. And you're going to go there and you're going to see Lenin all entombed. And then you're going to go next door, and there's going to be Putin, and you're going to look down.
Yeah.
And there's going to be that darn ring.
Yeah.
The guy is a thug.
But he's a Patriots fan now.
Yeah.
So give us some hope.
Well, listen, I see, you know, you're going beyond the resilience I talked about with John Meacham and his book, The Soul of America. I see a lot of hope in a couple of things. One is the younger generation that's coming. And we saw some of that with the Parkland kids. Mm-hmm. So articulate, so knowledgeable. And one of the secrets, by the way, to their success, as I learned, I met with seven of them. They came up to the Cambridge for a visit, was that they had great civics teachers. Mm-hmm. You know, we've taken civics out of the classroom. Mm-hmm. And we really need Sandra Day O'Connor launched a wonderful effort after she got off the court to restore civics. But a lot of these younger people I see come through, and there's no better example than what I'm particularly fond of right now and working with, are the young veterans who are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm. They remind me so much of that World War II generation that I spoke about. Mm. They're full of hope for the country. They fought under the same flag. They think our politics now is BS. They don't like it. They want to turn the page. And there's an effort now that I'm spending a fair amount of time with to elect more young veterans to Congress in this time out. Mm-hmm. Republicans as well as Democrats. I'm less interested in the partisanship angle than and the point if you can elect people who are more centrist and who know what it's like to take going to Congress a lot easier than being in Iraq, believe me. And they know what it's like to sacrifice for the country. They're committed to the country. And they put that, the country way above the partisanship as a value. So I think we have over 200 veterans, young veterans now running for Congress. And I'm involved in three organizations raising money for them. There are two. There's a young man named Seth Moulton who's in comes from the North Shore of Massachusetts as a Democrat. There's a young man named Mike Gallagher who comes from Wisconsin as a young Republican. And they're working together, and they're really terrific on that. Mm-hmm. Seth had an upset victory in Massachusetts, a long story, but the essence of it is that down right before the general election, the Boston Globe Insight team, as it's called, their investigative reporter team, ran a story about Seth. He was a Democrat, saying, "We've been trying forever to get Mr. Moulton's military records, and he won't share them with us. But we've been trying to figure out whether he's been lying to the voters about his service in Iraq. He had four tours in Iraq as a Marine infantry officer. And we still can't get his records, but we did find another source, and we now have them, and we see that, in fact, he has not been telling the voters the full truth about his military service. He's never told voters he has two medals for heroism coming out of Iraq. I called Seth. I've been with this young man for 15 years now. I said, "What the heck? I didn't know. Why haven't you told the voters?" And he said, "Well, first of all, I'm a Marine, and we don't brag. You know that.
Right.
And secondly, my enlisted guys deserved a lot of this, and they didn't get it. And so I don't feel good about talking about it. It turned out he hadn't even told his parents. He's not alone in the younger generation. That's the spirit of the younger generation, I find. They are really committed to trying to save the country. And they're not putting themselves first. They're putting the country first. So I'm very hopeful about that. But the other thing I'm very hopeful about is the revolution that's taking place practically among women. And the interest among women and the commitment among women to participate and get in the arena and fight for what they believe is very heartening. You know, and there's many of you familiar have heard of Emily's List, which is an organization in New York that works with young women who are running for office. You can call Emily's List if you decide to run for local, school board, or you want to run for the city council, anything up to the national level. You can call Emily's List. They'll help you raise money. They'll help you put together a team and so forth and so on. In the last election cycle in 2016, almost 1,000 women called Emily's List for help. In this election cycle, so far, 36,000 women.
Ooh.
36,000 women.
Wow.
And that gives me hope. I believe that if women are more fully represented and we move toward that, we embrace gender balance as a national priority, I think it will change our politics. I really honestly believe I'd like to see more of these veterans, and I'd love to see more women come in. I think our politics will get a lot better. So don't lose hope. You know, I think my confidence is shaken, but my hope is not.
Good.
So let's just stick together. Remember, we've got a lot of resilience. We've got a lot of strengths to fall back on, and we're all in the same ship together. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Our Commonwealth Club is officially adjourned, and we thank David Gergen so much. Thanks, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.